Hi, Liz.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. My grandson is here.
What? Oh, wait.
Yeah. You want to see him?
Yeah, wait a minute. Do you mean?
Yeah, let me go.
Okay. He's here just for right now.
Oh, okay.
They're not moving back until October, but they are moving back.
They are not.
They are. Wyatt decided he's getting out. Yeah, I think your exit date's like what, the 15th of October?
Early October.
Hi, baby. Hi. Isn't
Oh
he
my gosh, he's so
cute? Weston,
cute.
look at, look at.
Hi.
Oh.
Oh
Oh, look, there's Chris.
my goodness.
Say hi.
Chris, how old is he?
He is 9 months old.
Oh boy, that's a
Eight months
great
old. Eight
age.
months old. I'm sorry.
I like that age even better. Look at
Yeah.
you. You're such a big boy. Oh
Yeah.
my gosh.
He's going with his mommy tomorrow to meet family.
Oh.
So I get my son all to myself all weekend.
Fabulous.
Yeah, so I took vacation. We're going to go do some stuff. Hi,
Wonderful.
baby.
Supposed to
Hi,
be beautiful this weekend, too.
baby. Oh, you're very smiley.
Smiling. He's a happy boy. Oh my gosh.
Yes, he is.
I feel like the last time I talked to you, he was just being born.
Yeah, Monica's pregnant now.
I know. And so when you said your grandson was here, I was like, wait, she didn't have the
Yeah.
baby already?
No, Monica's not due until September, but she's having another boy, so it'll be three boys.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Daddy's almost done.
Aw, he's so cute, Liz.
Yeah. That's always fun to have him come visit.
Oh yeah, I
Are you
bet.
ready to see Daddy? Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right, back to business.
We all need a baby break sometimes.
Oh, especially lately. We've been so busy at work. Oof.
Yeah, I know. It just never ends. Everything.
Well, it's good because there's a lot of building.
Yeah.
The commission will be happy to know that Columbia Care paid for their permit. So they should start breaking ground on that soon.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So they have a development here in Medford that's not that far away from my house, and I drive by it all the time. And I've just been watching it go up, and it looks really nice. I think it's
Yeah.
great. There was a lot of neighborhood opposition to it, which is ironic because it's like, every county has the sign that says we support veterans or like we love veterans, but then it's like,
Yeah.
well, we don't want to house them in our
Yeah.
neighborhood.
Exactly. And the minute you say low income, people instantly just go, oh.
Yeah, so they're almost done with that building. And I was thinking, like, now that they're done with this building, are they gonna start on the one in Ashland? Oh, so I'm so
Yeah.
glad. Hi,
I
Gina.
think in a couple of weeks they're gonna start breaking ground, so that'll be good.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Well, and I still have
What are you
people.
talking about breaking ground?
Oh, you should tell her, Liz. She.
What? Oh, Columbia Care purchased their permit this week, so they should be breaking
Yes.
ground soon.
Yes, that's what I was hoping to
Yeah.
hear. Bill told me that. We had a discussion with Bill Molnar, and he was telling me about
Yeah,
that.
it's exciting.
I'm like, yay! Progress, huh, you guys? Things are
Well, and
moving.
I saw Rogue Retreats is working on their place that they did the motel they're converting, so that's good.
Yeah, lots of good stuff happening out there.
Yeah.
And how about East Main?
East Main.
The church, how is that going with the opportunity to put pallets over
Well,
and
that
sell through?
yeah, that property is actually in the county. So they have to go through county to do that.
Yes.
Yeah, but I thought that there was movement on that, or am I wrong?
Linda would know more.
So Gina, we broke ground on that, Aura did, by working with the county to get the let us have a shelter there.
Yeah.
But it is the county. So they have been through the process a little bit now of sheltering people, and they're getting more and more used to that concept. So there's always hope.
Well, I did hear that there is hope on that end for having pallet houses and working with the county on that. I'm going to see if I can find an email really quick.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
When we were, Aura was in transition from the winter shelter to actually taking over. And we went door to door in the neighborhood to make sure the neighbors felt okay with having the winter shelter there. And even with all the stuff we did, it took a year to get it approved by the county. And so it's not fast,
yeah.
Not easy. And
unfortunately, the county doesn't move as quickly as some of the jurisdictions because I don't know if they feel removed from the homeless problem or I don't know.
They're very concerned that people will stay in that area and loiter. And one of the big selling points for us when we were setting up the shelter there was that we would bus everyone out each morning and mm-hmm. bus people in the evening. And that made people feel much better about it. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be an easy sell to have pallets there. I think it'll be hard.
I think it'll be very hard.
Yeah.
They'll have to be porta potties or I don't know.
Well, and it's far away. I mean, not super far, but it's not very close to services like a grocery store or, you know, something like that either.
And there's not a big shoulder on that road. So it's mm-hmm. a little dangerous to to walk there, especially at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not straightforward. It's not an easy sell.
No. Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Linda and Linda. Linda 1 and Linda 2.
Yep. we're all here. Are we missing somebody? I think this is all of us.
Oh, and Linda Rapond is called Linda Reed on her screen. I like that. Look at that.
Well, because Linda Reed is actually community development.
Yeah, I see that. So what do we have Brandon as? Oh, Brandon's Brandon. Okay.
Well, so I sent the link to Linda because the other link got lost. So she's ends up coming in as me, but there she goes. And I'm going to change mine too.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's where sharing links can be problematic. Fortunately, you could use the city's one. Otherwise, only one of you could have joined with that link.
It's right at 4 o'clock in my on my calendar. So let's get started. Rich has asked me to chair today, so I'm going to be sort of facilitating us through this meeting. I'm glad you're all here. First thing on our agenda is approval of the minutes.
I have one thing I'd like to edit, please.
Did I spell your name wrong again?
No.
Okay.
you did great. It was the adjournment part. The adjournment part was kind of missing. It says at PM.
Yeah, I fixed that. It was 6:15.
Okay. No problem.
I just have one thing too mm-hmm. for you, Liz, and I don't know if it shows up in the minutes or just on the agenda, but changing that the council liaison, my name, Jackie Bachman, is there instead of Gina Duquesne. Okay.
Yeah. I changed that too after I sent it. Yeah.
Okay. It was a good memory though.
But they did happen.
Yeah.
Any other changes? Heidi? Nothing? motion to approve?
I move we approve the minutes as presented.
I'll second.
Okay.
Motion by Rich, second by Jackie. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Moving on. Do we have people who are here for the public forum today?
So we do have some people here, but it looks like they are not here for public forum. We just have Beth Goodman, Cass Sinclair, Lita, and Mary Farrell, who will all be presenting later, except for Lita, who I believe is just listening.
Okay. And none of you want to speak, correct? Yet. We'll get to you. All right, moving on. The big bulk of our meeting today is the presentation by Brandon, The housing capacity analysis discussion. So we're really going to allocate an hour to this, which I presume, Brandon, is some is discussion as well as.
Yeah, most definitely. Beth Goodman from Echo Northwest is joining the meeting right now, and she has been the consultant that through the Department of Land Conservation and Development, we received a grant in order to produce a housing capacity analysis. It's part of House Bill 2003, where all communities in the state are looking at their housing needs, their land supply, and ensuring that there's a correlation between that we have enough land to accommodate our future growth. And so Echo Northwest has done quite a bit of work and worked with the advisory Housing Capacity Analysis Advisory Committee, which does include members of this commission as well. Echo Fields and Heidi Parker have been in attendance at those meetings. We've had three of those meetings to date. The Planning Commission met to discuss the strategies that are outlined in the memo that were submitted to this commission. They met on Tuesday to discuss those. And now we're bringing those strategies to you. There's five overarching strategies that Beth is going to go through. And hopefully this is discussion in terms of the more input you can provide, the better informed we'll be at putting together the final housing capacity analysis. And with that, I'd like to introduce Beth Goodman, who you've met before at the joint study session that we had on January 28th. And she can go over where we've gotten to from then.
Thank you so much, Brandon. I just want to comment that listening into you all talk before you started the meeting just made my heart happy. The stuff you were talking about. And that's the stuff, a lot of it we're here to talk about today. So I'm going to very briefly go over a little bit of information on a PowerPoint, which I need to share my screen, otherwise you can't see it. This is a short PowerPoint, and then I would like to spend the majority of our time together talking about the policies. So as a reminder, here's our project schedule. We need to be done entirely by June 15th because that's when the grant ends. And we are in fact on schedule, we are here. So as Brandon mentioned, we've had three meetings with the advisory committee. We've met, this is our second time talking with you, and we've met with the Planning Commission. And what we have coming up next is, I guess we're actually a little bit more like here. What we've got coming up next is an open house that we'll talk about at the end of the meeting. But the open house is going to be online because of where we are in the times. And will be sent out via a method the city has that gets to many, many, many people. So just a very brief review of the results that we discussed with you about the housing needs analysis, the housing capacity analysis. The results essentially haven't changed. Looking at the entire analysis, we're looking at growth of about 858 dwelling units within Ashland over the 20-year period. So that's households. Ashland has, I don't have a sum here, but Ashland has way more capacity for housing than the forecast of dwelling units. But one of the things that was asked for is how much of that capacity is within the city limits versus within the urbanizing area, so the area between the city limits and the urban growth boundary. And so that's part of what we're bringing to you here. What this is this is vacant unconstrained land within either the city limits or the urbanizing area, where we have pulled from the buildable lands inventory the capacity in terms of dwelling units in those areas. And so I'll use the low density areas, which is a combination of all of these areas as an example. So the city has about 590 units of capacity on vacant land in the low density areas that's within the city limits, and almost 400 dwelling units of capacity in the urbanizing area. So outside the city limits, but inside the UGB. So before that land can be developed, it has to be annexed into the city limits. And that's the barrier, is that annexation. And where there's really a substantial issue is that the suburban residential, most of that, there's not a lot of it, is in the urbanizing area. But the normal neighborhood, all of that is in the urbanizing area. And before that can develop, it has to be annexed into the city. About half of your multifamily residential is inside the city limits and half is outside. And then we also look at some land in high density that's all inside the city limits, and then land in commercial. So when we look at the forecast for new housing, as we've allocated it out to different plan designations, as well as group quarters, which is a minor issue, what we see is that you can accommodate all of your need in the low density with land you've got in your city limits, but you start to need to annex land in to take care of need in suburban residential and normal neighborhood, and some of the need in multifamily. The other thing that's notable is you just don't have a lot of land in your high density zone. So you have just enough land there, but you also have a little bit of extra that we haven't counted necessarily, potential capacity in commercial. So the big picture here is annexation is going to be important, especially for the normal neighborhood. And you've got enough land inside your urban growth boundary to accommodate growth. So it's not about having enough land, it's about the details within having enough land and how you deal with that. Before I go on, are there any questions? I'm going to talk more about policies in a moment. Okay. So then going on to the policies.
I had a question.
Yes, sir.
And I didn't know if we were asking questions as we go along, but it seemed to me that is there any way that we can't change, but how do we evaluate the population growth that it looks like PSU just extrapolated from where we are. And consequently, we get a very minuscule growth, which means we don't have to have very many affordable housing, particularly as much as they would. And part of the, if they did it exponentially, just by kind of looking at where we've been, we have been an elitist city that has very expensive housing, hence we don't grow. We made that decision. Is it all right that the city just continues that sort of 20 years of low growth, regardless of, and hence a low amount of needed housing? If we created the housing, wouldn't we have more growth? I guess that's my question.
You point out a good point. And what I would say first, I'll answer the bigger question first. Is it a problem that you've got the forecast you've got? Well, no, because you're not likely to have a forecast that would be so much larger that all of this additional capacity that are in these last two columns would be eaten up, or even most of it. The only place you start to come close is high density residential, but your employment and your commercial zones function as a release valve for your high density residential. In other words, you've got development opportunities there, and they certainly are happening somewhat.
I was relating it to the housing need. Does this relate to the need to create housing, and are we getting an artificially low need to create housing?
And so maybe. I haven't tried to evaluate it. Is it a good forecast? But what I'm saying is, to a certain degree, it doesn't matter if it's a good forecast because you have additional capacity. And so it's not that you're limited to, you can only grow 858 dwelling units. You could grow as many dwelling units as the city can fit in it in the next 20 years and as much development as would be financially feasible within the city.
Excuse me, I'm for that as long as mm-hmm. when we explain it to the city council mm-hmm. that we don't encourage them to think that we only need
yes.
this amount. That's how much we could do, but we could do a lot more. And if they want to be a more diverse community, they need to do a lot more. That would be my only, and I'll stop.
I understand your point entirely, especially when you start to talk about affordable housing. Building affordable housing anywhere is hard. In Southern Oregon, it's harder. In Ashland, it's kind of extra hard because you're such a desirable community. And so most of the policies, the ones I'm especially interested in talking over with you, are aimed very much at that. It's a big rock to push uphill, essentially. So were there any other questions? The other thing I'll remind you is that because of House Bill 2003, cities are now required to review their housing capacity analysis every 8 years. And so at a minimum, the city will be required of reviewing it again in 8 years. And if the city chose to review it sooner than that, of course, the city, I believe, could. So I'm going to go on to policy. I'm actually going to close my drapes a little bit here because it's too bright for me out there. All right. So looking at Ashland's strategic priorities for housing. First of all, what does this study give you? This study gives you everything above the dotted line. It gives you the housing capacity analysis, and then it also gives you a housing strategy that talks about the bullet points that we've got listed there. What you have to do after this project is done, within a year of adopting the housing capacity analysis, the city needs to develop a housing production strategy, which essentially is taking your strategy and detailing it out a lot more. So what are we going to do to address this particular need? Oh, this strategy we had identified addressed that need, and you know, so on and so forth. And then the city eventually adopts its housing production strategy, which commits the city to at least attempting to do each of the action items, each of the strategies in that document over a 8 year period. If the city is unable to do one, say you consider increasing building heights, for instance, and it's decided that increasing building heights is just not feasible for whatever reason, then the city has to report that to the state and say, we couldn't do this, but we're doing this other action instead, and it will address that need. So your commitment there is, you know, genuinely trying to implement the strategies and then proving how you're meeting the need with something else. So the housing production strategy is going to lead, I expect, to changes to the zoning code and probably changes to housing policies and programs. Let's just talk zoning code changes. Zoning code changes are going to require the typical amount of public input, say through the Planning Commission, as you have with any zoning change. Developing a housing program is going to require the kind of public input that you have, say through this group, through the city council, et cetera, that you'd have with developing any program. And so what I'm telling you is the housing production strategy is essentially going to give you a work program for the next 8 years. What are we going to do? There's a lot of public involvement in that execution of that work program. So that's what's coming. In other words, a whole lot more discussions. and some actions.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the things I noticed in rereading some of the material is even though the projection for our population increase maybe is only 2,000 over the next 20 years, the change in the age of the population really stood out to me, because in the last 20 years, about it was, I think it was 2,000 people that were over 60. In the next 20 years, I believe it was 18,000 more in the age group of over 60.
That's for the whole county.
Oh, for the whole county. Okay.
Yeah, no, no. Not all of Ashland is suddenly going to become over 60. Yeah. No.
Okay, but for the county, because if that is the case, then for the county, mm-hmm. the increase for our population will definitely be aging, I would say.
Certainly.
Yeah, so in terms of what we look at, in terms of smaller houses, more affordable houses, the ability to have maybe caretakers living on a property, those are all things that it seems that we're going to need to look very carefully at.
Yeah.
Yes, and some of those smaller houses might actually be housing that's also appropriate for younger people, your millennials and your Gen Zs, potentially as rental housing. Absolutely. And as people choose to leave their homes as they age or are forced to by circumstances, then those units will become open. And let's just hypothesize that some of them are larger single family units. Those will become available to presumably younger households in a lot of cases, and potentially people with children. So there'll be churn is what I'm saying. And one of your big needs is indeed for smaller units, as well as a need for affordable ownership units as well. And that's something that we heard a lot about in the Planning Commission meeting on Tuesday. And we haven't worked those comments into the document you have, because it was just Tuesday.
One comment I'd like to make, and to correlate a bit of what Rich said and a bit of what you said, Jackie, the population projection talking about a very small increase in population over time, but in terms of an aging population, we're also seeing and have seen a decreasing number of people per household. So as you have an aging population, you have a lot more 1- and 2-person households. So interestingly, even though we have low population growth, we need more housing to accommodate that same number of people. If it was 3 people per household, instead of needing 850 units in the future, if we had a 3-person per household, we'd probably only need 600 units in the future. But we only have 2 people per household, so that's where that number comes from. So it does kind of match up that population growth and the demographic growth that we're seeing historically and in the future.
Are there other questions or comments? Chris?
So on the minimum resident densities, do we have a large percentage of single home detached housing and high density zones?
You have jumped ahead to the policies.
Sorry.
That is okay. Let me open a file. And Brandon might actually be able to answer that, because he just knows the answer.
Yes. There's a significant number of single family homes in multifamily zones and in high density residential zones, namely Ashland's preponderance of historic districts. The railroad district is zoned for multifamily, but you have a lot of single family in those zones, as well as in the other historic districts around the downtown. But there is a minimum density requirement in our land use code that was adopted, I'd say, a decade ago, that says if a multifamily zone property is developing, it has to develop out at 80% of its allowable density. And that does, in some cases, townhomes meet that requirement. So they're still single family homes, but single family detached homes are relatively rare in multifamily zones at this point for new construction. because the land value and people are typically looking at maximizing the number of units that could be located on those parcels.
So as an example, in your multifamily residential area, you had 42 dwelling units that developed, I don't remember the exact period, but let's call it over more than the last 10 years. Of those 30 were multifamily. You have a lot less, sorry, of those 30 were single family. You have a lot less of that in your high density zone recently that have recently developed. So before we go on and get into the policies a lot, I just want to give a reminder that Ashland has influence over the development that happens, but you're not entirely in the driver's seat. In other words, you can influence public policy, so zoning and densities, design requirements, how much land you've gotten to the urban growth boundary, you can influence that and through annexation, and where you have infrastructure. And part of that, of course, is a matter of paying for new infrastructure. You can have some influence on things like market feasibility of new development through things like tax exemptions, waiving SDCs. You may have a little bit of opportunity to influence capital availability for things like rehabilitation if the city looks at low-cost loans for rehabilitation of existing affordable housing. You don't have much influence on capital. And so it's only when all four of these elements are present that development can occur. And I am going to skip any of the rest of the slides so that we can go talk about the policies. My thought on this, and you guys can tell me you want something different, is that in the policies, and this is the memo that we sent you, in the policies, you might want to speak to talk more, because we only have about 50 minutes, about strategies 3 and 4. But you can give us, you know, comments on any of these. Do you prefer to start with strategies 3 and 4 and then return to 1 and 2? Okay. So I'm seeing some nods. So we'll start with strategies 3 and then go on to 4. And my intention here is to simply say, what of these do you have comments on or concerns on? And we'll look at them more closely. And I could do a round robin if you'd like us to do that.
Well, this, oh, go ahead, Jackie, then I got to come.
Okay. One of the things that I'm wondering more about is establishing a land bank or doing more land banking. Can we talk a little bit about that? How we could maybe have that come about more? I think Umpqua has sort of helped with that concept a little bit, but it seems like that's a possibility that might help with affordable housing, a way to do it.
Certainly. And I'm less familiar. Let's see, policy action 3.4 is about establishing a land bank or participating in one. Did you have particular comments or are your questions, what would you need to do?
Yeah, it's more how do we attract, whether that's the Jackson County, land authority to come in? How do we make it more inviting for people to work with us on doing the land banking? Or how do we do it, in the city?
So the first question with a land bank is, what does the city have to put in? Does the city have resources? Do you have money?
No.
Or, I know.
Well, we're
do you have land that is publicly owned that is surplus to need. Mm-hmm. So do you have something to contribute to a land bank? Once you've, if you've got something to contribute, you're in a better position.
Okay, so let's say we have the land, we find land that we could contribute.
Okay. And Brandon, you may have some thoughts before I start babbling on here a little bit.
So the two different approaches, one, identifying surplus city property that is deemed surplus, you know, so Lithia Park would not fit that category, but other park property that is not being utilized might, at which point then that land could be set aside for the purpose of development of affordable housing. And sit idle for a number of years until an affordable housing developer has a project that could utilize that property. You could see what was done over on Clay Street as a form of land banking, because the city acquired with the housing authority and city funding 10 acres of property, selling some surplus city property and putting the money into those. And then when the time came, sell that property to the housing authority at the original purchase price. And so in that way, the escalating land value over time does not burden that housing development and is essentially a subsidy in that way. The other method would be is if there was a revenue stream that could actively seek out property and assemble properties outside of our city limits, right, within the urban growth boundary, because those are properties that most developers would look at it having, you know, significant barriers to development, no infrastructure, those kind of things, and buy them and hold them until such time as you could coordinate the infrastructure improvements with our transportation system plan or capital improvements plan, set those properties up to then be put back onto the market for affordable housing, and in that way funneled to specific affordable housing providers that would provide the type of housing that's requested. So I think that is the method by which you do it, but I think the big issues are what land do we have that's considered surplus? And outside of that avenue, how much revenue does the city have available to put towards acquisition of property with a long-term vision in terms of how it would be put into affordable housing production?
I'd like to comment. This one is one of my highest priorities in terms of a lot of great policies that we get to discuss. Land bank and land trust are absolutely crucial for getting affordable housing. The thing about this, it said we either need to participate in or create. Well, there isn't one to participate in. So as a housing commission, we need to create with the city. We need to say there, because we need to command the notion of both available land that the city owns and resources that could be developed, because this is one of the really key things that allows us to move beyond sort of episodic affordable housing. So that's all my thoughts.
And so what I would say part of what the city might want to do is in its housing production strategy, investigate the land banking process in more detail, and maybe have some discussions with nonprofits in the area who either already do land banking or who might be interested in a land bank. One of the things that the city, I think, decision makers need to ask themselves is, does the city want to be running a land bank, or do they really want to look for a nonprofit to run the land bank? I don't have an opinion. Echo, you've got comments?
Right. Couple of things. Is there, in the buildable lands inventory, is that where there is a map of where the surplus land is at present, Brandon?
Yes. Oh, so yes? The buildable lands inventory doesn't identify surplus city lands.
Okay, that was my question.
It identifies vacant and partially vacant.
So it's a map of the surplus city land that...
Well, it's a map of land that has further development potential. That's the BLI. A map of surplus city land does not exist because really? The city would have to designate a property as surplus in order to sell it or dispose of it.
Interesting.
So currently all properties are in use. There are properties that have been considered as potential surplus properties, and that was mapped probably about 5 years ago with a lot here or there that the city isn't currently utilizing, but they haven't technically been designated as surplus land. So I might be getting into a bureaucratic definition.
That's quite interesting. Thanks for clarifying that.
So part of your action for 3.5 in your housing production strategy might well be taking another run at that process for identifying surplus land.
Because without that, it's kind of hard to think, okay, what do we have to work with, whether it's a land bank or land trust? What do we have to work with? So that seems to me like something that I'd like to see to be able to visualize. And then I have these perverse fantasies about, do we really need a golf course? Wouldn't it be great to convert the golf course to housing, which would benefit a far greater percentage of the population? Now, I know that that's blasphemy, but I'm saying it anyway.
Is that a public golf course?
Yes. It's Ashland Parks and Rec. Yeah. And Ashland Parks and Rec is its own entity, kind of separate and distinct from the city council, which is another interesting issue in our community.
You're not alone in raising that. That was raised, I think, probably 8 or 9 years ago. And I think Rich will remember the discussions that occurred.
I can imagine it was not pleasant. But I wanted to say it anyway. And then I'm also a little curious, and this is kind of also in the realm of fantasy. Considering that SOU's budget is likely to be really bad for a good long while, and Chris probably knows this better than I do at the moment, I do wonder if SOU is going to be looking at selling off some land owned by the university. And if that's the case, you know, would some sort of deal be able to be struck with the city to make what was university land into bankable land for the city by some means? And I have no idea if that's at all a realistic fantasy or not, but just wanted to throw it out there.
So what I will say is that in Cottage Grove, for instance, the school district, which is not a university, had a parcel of land that was somewhere in the lines of 70 acres that they identified as surplus a long while ago and hadn't decided what to do with. And through as a result of their housing capacity analysis and the discussions afterwards, I believe that land is in the process of, in the development process for both workforce housing as well as other housing types. So there's certainly examples of where that has happened across the state. I think the trick is, what is SOU's goal with any land that they decided?
And I have no idea about that at this point. And just, I can imagine that, having worked there for over 20 years, that the budget is probably pretty dire. So, oh no. That was all I had.
Are there other comments on any of the actions under Action 3? I can run back to our table. Maybe. There we go. And Rich, your hand is still up, but I don't know if that means that you have a comment.
You're on mute currently, Rich.
You're still muted. I'm sorry.
You can't do it up on my picture. I don't know. I put it up a long time ago. Where do you, I got to find out where you, lower your hand. Okay. I did it.
Okay. No worries. Just wanted to make sure if you had a comment, you had an opportunity. If there's no other comments on Action 3, Strategy 3, I'm going to go on to Strategy 4. which is the fund strategy, which is find money to do things. And that's really hard. The first thing about establishing a construction excise tax, I'll just say when we talked about that yesterday or Tuesday, there were certainly people in the on the Planning Commission who have concerns about that, because in establishing a construction excise tax, that's taxing new home development. And it makes things marginally more expensive. The construction excise tax on residential development could be up to 1%. In Bend and I think Medford both, they started with somewhere around 0.3%, so 1/3 of a percent. So it doesn't have to be a whole percent. Another thing with urban renewal, that has a long history in Ashland of not having been used, but urban renewal is remarkably useful at developing infrastructure that's going to be necessary to support housing development. And then from there, you start to get to harder and harder to reach sources. Some cities have been in the Portland area, they've issued general obligation bonds to pay for affordable housing. Haven't seen many cities outside of the Portland area thinking about that. I think Bend might be. Heidi, you had a comment.
Yeah, is it possible that, is it legal to make construction excise tax apply to houses greater than a certain size? Like there's a really huge house next to Pioneer Hall that's way out of proportion to other homes in the area and just huge. And it's also just a single family residence, but it seems like there should be a way to something like a luxury tax if people are going to build huge homes.
I do not know the answer to that. And so I will find out the answer, and the answer might well be, there might be a way, but you need to talk to the city's attorney. So I'll see if we know the answer.
Well, okay. One of the ways that you can do it is, and I think cities have done it, is that they've exempted value. So they certainly have exempted affordable housing. So the more you exempt, the less money you get. But if people think it's going on affordable housing, it is not, I think, in any of the cities that have adopted it. So it's sort of like skewing it towards more valuable land. But I don't think you can address it to one size house or one set of houses. It would be based on value and exemption.
Units, say, worth more than $750,000 or something like that.
Yeah, so the construction excise tax, we mentioned 1%, but again, I think Ben did 1/3 of a percent based on value. A typical house is $196 a square foot for value. So let's say 200, so I can do the math. If someone's doing 1,000 square foot, that's a 200,000 square foot valuation. If you were, for instance, to exempt the first $200,000 worth of value from the calculation, and charge a construction excise tax that was higher, you would have the effect of charging more towards more expensive homes. But again, I think checking with the city attorney was great advice, and something that if Ashland goes down that road would be necessary to get a legal opinion on how that comports with state law.
Jackie had her hand up and then Echo.
Thanks. I had a question about urban renewal. I've lived and worked in cities before where urban renewal has brought in a tremendous amount of money, but it was brought in areas of the city that were considered blighted or, you know, very low value and needing great help for the infrastructure. So I have always thought that the urban renewal concept wouldn't fit with Ashland. Is that the problem, that we don't look at urban renewal, or how could we use urban renewal in Ashland?
Brandon, you've got the answer on this one too.
Well, Bill Molnar had the answer on it. Unfortunately, he gave some of that on Tuesday's meeting. So I can recall some of the specifics. A number of years back, the city did consider urban renewal and hired an individual by the name of Cashman that did the number crunching in terms of specific neighborhoods. And it was found that the downtown area up to the through the railroad district, including the railroad property, would qualify for an urban renewal district. Additionally, the Croman Mill area and down Ashland Street, it's more commercial in nature, but that also could have qualified. So part of that qualification is also not just the blighted conditions, but what kind of infrastructure is needed. And so looking at what's called tax increment financing, and Beth could probably articulate it better than I, but essentially the urban renewal looks at the current condition and kind of creates a baseline there. And anything that gets developed after urban renewal is done, the increase in tax revenue gets put back into that district to pay for infrastructure improvements. Typically, areas in Portland actually set up that a certain percentage would have to go back into affordable housing directly in that district. And so there are ways to do it, and there are parts of Ashland that have previously qualified to meet those requirements. So it likely could be done again. It's not only exclusively areas that are blighted in that way that we traditionally think about inner city neighborhoods that need significant help.
I don't have a whole lot to add unless there are other questions about urban renewal there. Linda?
Hi, I just had a quick thought about urban renewal, and I don't know that it really would apply in this instance, but I mean, we've heard a lot about the need to annex areas in the urban growth boundary, and that a lot of those areas lack that infrastructure, especially like the normal neighborhood and areas like that. And I wonder if those types of areas would be applicable to an urban renewal model, and if that would help sort of incentivize the development of those lands for specifically for affordable housing, but obviously just any sort of development, but hopefully meeting the needs that we could set out. I don't even know that you can do that with urban renewal, but.
I will check with my urban renewal expert. I kind of remember some discussion of something similar to that, but that's not a good enough memory to base an opinion on. So I'll check that out and bring back some information about that. Echo, you had a comment?
Yeah. Okay. I was trying to figure out how productive of revenue the construction excise tax is for the school district. And maybe Heidi knows, since she was on school board. I seem to recall that it's at 1%, that they have a full 1% rate. It goes into their capital improvement budget. I was trying to figure it out earlier today, and I'm not.
Yeah, the construction excise tax to the school is not based on value. It's based on square footage, and it's $1.07 per square foot for a residential, 54 cents for commercial development.
Do you know how much they generate for their budget with that?
I can find that out. We do. We actually collect those at the point of building permit, and our finance department sends them a check quarterly. So we could determine how much construction excise tax is collected on behalf of the school district.
Yeah, that I think would be useful, at least for comparative purposes. I know that anything with the word tax in it is probably toxic right now in Ashland politics.
I think a couple years ago, we did an analysis of the construction excise tax based on valuation as development that occurred in 2016, 17. Mm-hmm. I think Linda worked on that. And I think it was $160,000 would be the construction excise tax intake, averaging a 10-year period of growth within the city. So
yeah, it would be good. I'd like to know more about that.
And again, I think that's part of the activity that in identifying to move forward with that action is do all of that analysis to come back and make informed decisions.
Yeah. And I have a couple of other things. Is there any hope that anything is ever going to be done with the railroad property? Or should we just give up and realize that it's just going to lie there dormant for the rest of our lives?
I would say there's always hope. There is, you know, we've gone through a couple false starts in the past. You know, my understanding is the railroad has reached out to the city as recently as the last few weeks. So, you know, again, changes in market conditions, valuation of that property haven't gone up. That changes some of the metrics for them, I'm sure. Okay. So hopefully we'll have some cleanup that can get done there and prime it for development.
So the incentives for the rail, what kind of incentives could the railroad be seduced with?
I'm not sure. I know they have significant cleanup costs. And so that would be, you know, the market value of the property is a pretty good incentive. The cleaning up the property and removing the contaminated material is the cost that they're looking at. I think changes in federal law that changed under the Trump administration, what counts as a contaminant, made that process less expensive because they have to do less of a cleanup. So I don't know if that can be considered an incentive, but
well, and a perverse one, but
yeah.
And then my third question was something that I latched onto, I think, later in the document about HUD Section 108 loans. Would now be a good time to get a little more schooling on that, or should we do it later?
Okay. I'm not an expert in Section 108 loans, so if you ask me questions, I may be able to get them answered. I think that's probably way in the end of the document.
Okay, and maybe this isn't the right time, but it's something that piqued my interest, so and I wanted to...
Yeah. I can certainly talk more about Section 108 loans, and that's something that we have talked about in the past and have considered. So we can talk about that probably at a future meeting. And I don't know if that's, I mean, it is a funding source. Is that something then that we want to include in this process? And if so, we could talk about it sooner.
Yeah. And I know the word loan is scary to people because loans have to get repaid. And that means they have to have money to be repaid with. So I get that it's complicated, but.
Well, the Section 108 loan is actually a loan against your future CDBG allocations. And so the danger of that is that your allocations change every year. So you could potentially get less than the amount that you estimated your loan on. And then obviously the big, sort of danger would be if you stopped being an entitlement jurisdiction altogether and you didn't get any more money. So then, yeah, you would be on the hook to pay back that loan.
And yeah, and you can end up robbing Peter to pay Paul. And
yeah. Essentially the annual CDBG allocation would just be turned over to pay loan payment.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Are there other comments here? So I'd like to make sure, I don't know, I won't call on people. Shall we go talk about policies 1 and 2, or do you like to talk about policy 5? 5, I'm seeing some 5s. All right, so align housing planning with the climate action plan. Which of those are you interested in talking about?
So is it okay for me to go?
Yeah.
So one of the things I was wondering, you know, we were looking at our last meeting at different tools that could help us look at projects and recommendations through a social equity, racial justice kind of a lens. And also, looking possibly at involving climate challenges in this same lens is an interest I have. And that was when we were looking at the triple bottom line, I think was the name of the assessment that Eugene is using. And I was looking at the list here of different strategies for aligning the housing with the climate and energy action plan. And it just seemed like there was a nice list of things that we could look at possibly when we're considering different recommendations on projects. So that was something I would like to see some kind of a checklist that we could include, a simple one to start with, but that would have us look at how are we meeting the challenge with our climate and energy action in Ashland, and realizing that this lends itself many times to more expense in the development and for the developers. And so there, I realize there's a balance in all of this, but I just want to make that recommendation. It seems that we could use this information to develop a list to check.
So if we modified action 5.2 slightly, evaluate opportunities to include elements of the CEAP into housing developments, and just mention somewhere in here the idea of a checklist. Would we want this to be a voluntary checklist at first, or, you know, decide if it was a voluntary or a required checklist through your housing production strategy?
I think it would be fine to start it as, you know, a recommendation. It, you know, when we look at projects, we often go through, or the staff goes through, a point system looking at how a particular grant application or project, you know, is meeting the needs in different areas. It doesn't say you have to, but if you get a 1, 2, or a 3 point count, you know, if we had a checklist that included some of these in there, I think that would be very beneficial in moving forward.
Can I ask a point of clarification on that?
Yeah.
So, you know, I can see it in two different ways. One, having that checklist that is utilized in terms of evaluating projects that are receiving city funding. Mm-hmm. And that would differ from something that applies to all housing or a commercial development within the community. So were you looking at first or the second or both?
Well, I'm really looking at both, but okay. I think we could lead by example if we started with projects that are coming forward, you know, using city money and coming through Housing and Human Services. I'm hoping that in the end, overall, the commissions that will come up with a lens that will include, you know, the whole concept of social equity, racial justice, and climate challenges together somehow.
And I'll incorporate that idea in. I just want to mention the fact that part of what's difficult about developing in Ashland is that you guys have a complex development process. Yeah. That makes development less likely to happen in Ashland. I've had people say, well, why do things happen in Talent that don't happen in Ashland? This is the kind of reason why. So there's a price to doing something like this. I'm not saying that doing something like this is right or wrong. I'm just reminding you of you know, the complexity and the price. So yeah. I think Echo has a question. And you have to unmute yourself.
Okay, there we go. So Talent's about to get sued over being lax in oversight in what was supposed to be a mobile home development and had infrastructure up to code for mobile homes, but people started building stick-built on top of it, and it was not up to code for stick-built. And it's one of the communities that burned down, and now to replace it, rebuild on that property, they're going to have to completely redo the infrastructure, and that revealed this sweetheart deal that was made 20 some odd years ago, apparently, when they weren't doing oversight on development and Talent. So I'm kind of glad sometimes that we are difficult. But what I wanted, I was watching the planning, part of the Planning Commission meeting the other day. And the meet, I think Brandon, you were at that one, about the wildfire construction standards under the Oregon Residential Specialty Code. And it was a pretty interesting conversation about materials for new construction that are designed to mitigate wildfire hazard. And so that kind of connects to action 5.2 in this document. So another thing that we need to align is this document with what's happening over there with the Planning Commission with wildfire building standards. And as I understood the meeting, that applied only to new construction, not remodeling. Am I correct in my understanding, Brandon, about that?
Yes. An internal remodel of a house wouldn't have to go out and wrap their eaves or put on ignition resistant siding. But if
did those standards apply to affordable multifamily housing as well?
It applies to all construction within the city.
Okay, so that goes back to Jackie's concern about potentially adding to some cost. And there was some discussion among the commissioners.
Yeah, there was a report provided that showed that the implementation for new construction could add as much as $2,800 to the price of a house. And that was based off of a 1,200 square foot home.
Okay. So I don't know how to put that into this report, but it's another alignment issue. And then I had a question for Linda, also related, Linda Reed, related to resilience to natural hazards. I noticed for HUD under CDBG, there's a hazard mitigation grant program. Would Ashland qualify for any of that kind of funding connected with, you know, sort of picking up some of the costs of meeting more fire-resistant building codes?
No, I'm not quite sure which program you were looking at. Generally, when HUD advertises things or has grant funding for hazard mitigations, it usually is for existing, like, low-income housing, and it would be mitigating sort of issues like lead-based paint in an older housing stock, or sometimes there's that issue with radon in existing housing stock. And then they did have a whole initiative about healthy housing that was related to the number of children who got asthma from the indoor air conditions. And there is a program going right now, and this may be the one that you're talking about. And it is a comprehensive sort of rehab loan for existing affordable housing complexes to address some of those health and safety concerns.
I think this was different.
Okay. And
there was supposed to be some sort of webinar about it at the end of March. And it was connected. It looks like there were two programs connected related to each other, one for disaster recovery and then one for mitigating, sort of being more proactive about potential disasters.
FEMA has a hazard mitigation grant program that would be distinct from HUD. And that
this was at www.hudexchange.info.
Okay.
So I'll go back and find that page and email it to you.
Thanks, Echo. And I'll do a little research and see what I can find too.
Yeah. That's all.
So we've got about 10 minutes left. I noticed that Linda and Chris and Tom and Gina haven't said much of anything. Maybe it's because you don't want to speak and I don't want to force you to speak. But is there anything you want to comment on here? Tom had his hand up, then Chris. But you have to unmute. I'm sorry, Tom.
I don't have any real questions, but I really think the report offers a good array of strategies to address the identified needs. And to me, acquiring the land, modifying regulations, developing funding, and incentivizing development are the goals. And you've very nicely laid out all those possibilities for us. And I think it's a very excellent report.
Oh, good. And there's lots more choices that is stuck in Appendix A, which goes on and on forever. So, Chris, you had any comments?
So I just really want to echo what Rich said earlier about the land bank and as well as the land trust. Strategy 3 was definitely one of my favorites when I was going through all these items. So I'm not going to repeat what everyone said, but the only question that I have remaining is about rezoning. I noticed that in the appendix, there was a section that discussed about examining low dense vacant lots. And I would like to also probably see that as well as, you know, the strategy going forward is just taking another inventory of seeing what's out there and then possibly using that land.
So I think what you're suggesting is looking at if there are opportunities to upzone from low density to something that's higher.
Yes.
Okay. And then, Rich, I think you had your hand up.
Well, I had just kind of an overall question, and I thought the overall, this is a terrific document. It gives us a lot to go on. And there was one part of it, it had where you rate them low or medium or high impact. And I guess I didn't see that as completely relevant to what we want to do. It seemed kind of random. But my question is, who is the monitor for this, the work that we do, and how does it move forward? Because my fear is if we give it to the city council as is, they'll certainly discuss it. But how you move that whole thing forward is really, really difficult, and to understand it and to see which things you prioritize first in terms of policy. Is that going to be our job to look at this, these policies and then make recommendations that helps the council see the priorities that lie within it?
I'll answer the first question, then I'll defer to Brandon or Linda. So in the housing production strategy, each of these actions would be fleshed out further. And in that you would include a schedule for implementation. And a schedule, of course, partially implies a priority. And who would set up priorities and move things forward? I defer to Brandon, please.
Like the housing capacity analysis, the development of the housing production strategy would come back to this commission, planning commission, get input before it gets to the city council for adoption. And in that way, those items could be prioritized with public input. I would say that even in advance of a housing production strategy, there are opportunities to take on some of these actions, even again, in advance of that strategy being prepared and adopted. We don't need wait a year and to begin that process. So I think if there are things that stand out to this commission as clear priorities that are achievable in the short term, those are things that we should look at and bring back to this commission and the planning commission and city council. Again, there's no harm in doing them sooner rather than later, but I do think the housing production strategy, once adopted, does provide a framework for allocating staff time and allocating commission time in a systematic way to get that stuff achieved in a way that can have direct benefit sooner. Obviously we'd love to do all actions at once, but we don't have a staff of 50 people and resources to accommodate that. So Gina, did you have a question for me? Or?
This needs to be the last one because we need to move on. So Gina, and then we'll come to a conclusion.
Okay, thank you so much. I want to thank you for this because I feel like the presentation was very good. I appreciate the robust conversation around this. And so something that I kind of conclude as I heard, I'm excited about the excitement behind the land banking, because I do know that in April on the look ahead, the city council is going to discuss surplus land. and having that out there. So I invite everyone to come to that council meeting so that we can discuss the surplus land. I looked at November 18th, 2019, there was a study session. In the study session, Paula Brown was still with Public Works, and it has assess land use and structure and inventory, and it's like two pages. One page is pretty much parks and recs, and the other is just owned property by the city. So I invite everyone to come to that meeting in April to look at the surplus land that's owned by the city and see how we can use that. Also, something I'd like to say really quick is that when I was on the Housing and Human Services Commission, we met jointly with the Planning Commission. And to me, that was such, it was a wonderful opportunity to work together. And so as you move forward and kind of what you were saying, Brandon, and what Rich touched on, I think it would be great to prioritize, put your strategies together and meet together with the Planning Commission to be able to move things forward, because the land is there. The land banking is a wonderful opportunity. And what I see this short time that I've been on City Council is that the biggest thing is the cost to build, to incentivize. The only way we can get great developers here is to be able to look at those SDCs and to be able to look at the cost of building, and then we can get some workforce housing here in Ashland. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you to Beth and to Brandon. Not only is this a fabulous document, and I think extremely well done, and many commissioners have commented on that, it's also really a fantastic conversation today. So thank you for facilitating us to understand this better and engage with you about it. I think it helps on all fronts. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome to stay on or leave if you want. We're going to move into the community development block grant applications. We have presentations by the applicants, and then we'll have some conversation about that afterwards. Linda, do you want to say anything by means of getting started here?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Linda. So what we're doing this time is we're going to have the applicants present, and we'll go in alphabetical order because that's generally what we do. Both Mary Farrell from Maslow Project and Kathleen Clare from Options for Helping Residents of Ashland are here with us, and we'll have time for, we have, I think, a fair amount of time for them to just provide a brief overview of their projects, which you guys have all seen. The applications for, and then answer any questions that you may have. So I'm going to go ahead and promote Mary to be a panelist. Let's see here. And then she can share a little bit. Oh, sorry, Heidi, go ahead.
I just had a question about process. I know in the past, if anyone's on the board of anyone we're going to grant funding to, they need to declare that. And I'm not clear on whether they have to recuse themselves or not. So I just wanted to clarify that in the beginning so that it's in the notes if someone declares a connection to any of the agencies we're giving money to.
Thank you for bringing that up, Heidi. Do you want to go ahead and do that part, Linda?
Let's do that after the presentations. There's really no bias in listening to the presentation. When we get to our part of the discussion, we'll ask for conflict of interest and abstention. Is that all right?
I think in the past, the criticism we heard from City Council was that it matters if people participate in the discussion, and they recommended getting your biases first, and that it be recorded in the minutes. And I have no desire to repeat that horrible process that happened several years ago. And I hope we've all learned from that, and that it's the atmosphere is less adversarial now than it was then.
I hope so. So hearing that, does anyone have a conflict of interest that you need to declare or any other reason that you need to abstain? Jackie.
Hi. I just want to make it clear that I have no conflict of interest. I serve on the Aura board and I have no financial gain in serving on the board. And I feel that I can make fair and just decisions. So no conflict.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else? All right, let's move forward. Are we ready to welcome Mary? Thank you.
Yes, I was hoping Linda could confirm if we are being timed. I don't remember if this one has a limit.
We're good this time. Normally, yeah, we do. We have a pretty tight schedule, but I think we have some spaciousness. We're not going to time it and not going to be as militant as we have in the past.
That's okay. I'll try to be respectful of everyone's time. So I'm going to share my screen, if that's okay. Great. Is everybody looking at this photo of our building? All right, perfect. So this has been quite the year. I'm sure I don't need to explain that to everybody. Obviously, 2020 started out normal year. By early February, we kind of saw the writing on the wall and started thinking about how this potential pandemic might impact our clients and our mode of operation. And so by the March, stay-at-home order, we had already stocked up on personal protective gear that came from China. Back then, that seemed like a good decision. But we had really already thought about all the ways in which we could take what we do out of the normal mode of business and find an alternative way to continue to meet the needs. And sure enough, that did happen. And so while our resource center in Medford, which is what you're looking at now, and of course we have figure out how to actually this is our resource center in Grants Pass. We have another one over at the UCAN building. And then of course we're in all of the schools. So when all of the schools, let me flip to our, all of our schools closed, our resource centers closed, we were ready to convert all of our service to teleservices. We got laptops and smartphones and devices into the hands of a lot of our clients who didn't have one so that they could communicate with their caseworker and our outreach staff, which you're looking at here, via cell phone or email or social media. And we also just employed our outreach team out into the community so we could keep getting basic needs, hygiene supplies, personal protective gear, food, diapers, et cetera, to people who really needed it. And that was a really challenging period of time for folks who were experiencing homelessness. A lot of the parks and campgrounds, especially in the South Jackson County area, which typically we'd have some clients staying in outside of Ashland, closed. And so we had to relocate a lot of our Ashland families to Medford, where we put up a temporary parking lot that allowed car camping and tent camping. And we were able to get some facilities going, specifically like hand washing stations, bathroom facilities, and then meal deliveries. And we sort of already started putting really vulnerable folks at that time as we were learning. So anybody who was pregnant or had small children or elderly or medically fragile family members into hotels. So we sort of started with that. And that was we didn't know that was going to then turn into a compounding situation with the wildfires. But I guess the positive in that is because of COVID and the pandemic, we had already taken our entire operations from, you know, kind of where we were at to where our clients were at. So really, like, Maslow's never been as much about where we are as we are about who we are and what we do and what we're able to do. So it wasn't too hard to sort of deploy our staff in a similar way that you might get from like Instacart deliveries or Uber Eats. So all of our staff just loaded up their own vehicles and we were taking, you know, groceries and we were taking supplies. When the schools were really struggling to connect with families, especially in the early spring, what we found was that a lot of the individuals that we work with didn't actually have access to a phone, or they didn't know, like, when the school called, it was like a random number and they kind of weren't answering it. So we ended up losing about like 60% of the students we work with kind of got disconnected from that at-home learning. So what you're seeing in this upper right-hand photo is one of our case managers who just served as a liaison between the school districts, picking up hotspots, picking up Chromebooks, packet learning. And then you'll also see our other case manager with the graduation sign for Ashland last year and a graduate behind her. We were doing homework with these kids on park benches and making sure that they crossed the finish line. We got school supplies out. We really were like closing the gap between, you know, schools and parents and kids. And of course, a lot of parents didn't have childcare and they were the only source of revenue for their family, and unemployment wasn't exactly kicking in quickly. So there were a lot of families who were just sort of struggling to, do I quit my job and sit in a car and do at-home learning with my kid, or do I, you know, go to work and leave my kid alone? And so we really tried to like fill that void and help kids and help parents understand how to connect to their online learning and how to, you know, okay, if online learning isn't working, how do we get paper packets to you and advocate with your teacher for those materials? And it was a huge learning curve for everyone, but I'm really proud of our team's effort. And in spite of all of the chaos that ensued in the spring, we still saw 96% of our total seniors, that's 165 out of 168 seniors, graduate on time. And that's countywide. But that was like a huge, like, I don't even know, like, for even for us, that was like, wow, like, crazy success. So I'm really happy about that. And that kind of work continued into the summer, gearing up for this. Actually, photo was taken the morning that the fires broke out in the Phoenix Talent area. And of course, we continued to provide a lot of scholarships to the kids who did graduate last year. And we were working on getting those kids started for college or trade school or whatever their post-high school plans were. I got a call around 11 o'clock the day that the fire broke out from some of my case managers saying that their clients were being evicted from shelter environments or from other programs onto the streets in the middle of the fire. So we worked to help evacuate and relocate people into hotels, either in the Grants Pass area or further into Medford away from the Greenway. So we were very much involved from the beginning. A third of our staff also had to evacuate. So it was a really challenging period of time, but we were within like 24 hours at the expo and working with FEMA and the county and the local response and coordinating with the local schools. We had about 40 families show up from the Phoenix Talent area into the Ashland School District that were able to relocate either into a hotel or doubled up with a family member or friends. And so within a week, we had actually hired back Cheyenne Nichols, who some of you might remember from a couple of years ago. She was with us for a long time and she's been on maternity leave for 3 years, but now she is back full time with us. And we actually gave Ashland and Phoenix Talent more Maslow staff time than we've ever had before. So they each have their own full time advocate, and to help deal with some of the diversity, equity, and inclusivity challenges around, especially seasonal workers or part of members of the Latinx community, we hired a Spanish-speaking bilingual bicultural caseworker to really help make sure that those who were most affected and hardest to get connected to, like FEMA and the Red Cross, were also having some support in that area. So that was just sort of how we immediately responded to that. And then I'm going to go in a little bit to how that sort of segues to our application this year. But I don't know if I've given you guys a lot of chance to hear from our participants in the past. So I thought I would let you hear from two recent grads. And it's a very short video, and then I can wrap up pretty quick.
Hi, my name is Isabella.
And my name is Vinnie Pippa.
We are both students who have utilized the Maslow Project during our years in high school.
And on many days after a long commute to school and dropping my siblings off, I had to skip breakfast. But knowing I was able to eat in the Maslow room and feel comfortable made a huge impact on me and my siblings.
Maslow helped me acquire my food handler's permit and my alcohol handler's permit, bought me a shirt for work and shoes and all of the necessities that I needed to complete my job. I wouldn't have my job if it weren't for the Maslow Project.
And my siblings and I had the city bus to school, and the Maslow Project helped provide my siblings and I with bus passes, along with snack packs for me and my siblings.
My car's wiper busted in the winter, and the Maslow helped me buy a new one, along with a new tire when it popped later that year. The Maslow helped me get the parts that I needed to safely commute to school and to work. Along with my siblings' extracurricular activities, like dance and gymnastics and baseball and softball, the Maslow helped us pay for some of those activities and helped us easily get through the same as all the rest of the students at the school. I know many other students have been affected by the Maslow in these same ways, and I hope that you keep us all in mind. Thank you so much for your time. Hi.
So I just thought it'd be nice for you guys to hear from some of our actual students. And this has been a really challenging year, and a lot of kids have really struggled just being disconnected from their peers, disconnected from adults, feelings of isolation, depression, anxiety, as they've been out of school. And I think high school students, especially in Ashland, are still not back in class, but we are back in school. So when you heard him reference the Maslow room, that is a really nice space that we have right in the middle of the Ashland High School campus. It's has a private, you know, entrance, so it's not too obvious, but we have a little clothes closet, a hygiene and food pantry. And we've been back there meeting kids on campus, as well as continuing to meet with them remotely and off campus, out in public spaces, socially distanced, of course, and with all the proper protections in place. But we have just been really grateful that we've been able to get so many of our kids to be willing to come back to school and help them transition into either limited in-person living or learning, or in a couple of weeks, we should see most of our kids back on campus. A lot of school districts around the state and around the nation are really struggling with their dropout rates or kids who've just completely fallen off their radar. And we actually have seen that in some of our communities where Maslow is not in the schools. But in all of the school districts where we are a school-based presence, we've had pretty good success getting the majority of our kids back enrolled, attending, making progress. And we actually are not as concerned about what graduation rates are going to look this year as we thought we were going to be. So it's a little too early to say, but I'm feeling very optimistic. And how that sort of all ties in, because I think you guys are mostly familiar with our basic outreach in the community, our street outreach, our resource centers, and our school-based programs, because that's really what we've been doing for much of our history in Ashland, especially. But what's new and exciting this year, a couple of things, partially in response to COVID, and then I think the wildfires magnified the need for non-congregate shelter. So we did receive very generous support from the Ashland Housing Trust, and we've been able to spend about half of that so far on emergency hotel stays for our Ashland families and youth to keep them stable in the Ashland area. And of course, we've also received federal funds to help support that need too. So it's not that it's too much of a good thing, but with the Red Cross and some of the other resources, we anticipate we will have expensed all of that before the deadline is up at the end of summer. But that is actually interesting timing, because what you're looking at here is one of our new housing complexes with our partnership with the Housing Authority of Jackson County. This happens to be a complex that opened just about 18 months ago in Medford. This is called Newbridge. But as you're aware, Snowberry 2 is the complex that is being built in Ashland, and it's well underway. It's really beautiful. I drove by there the other day. So if you're not familiar with that, I hope you'll check that out. 12 to 15 of those units have been reserved as project-based vouchers for the families that we're working with in Ashland. So I heard you earlier in your study session today that you are really trying to promote affordable housing. And this is one of those things that aligns with that goal. And not only are those roughly 15 units going to be available for families that we've been working with, and we will bridge the gap. We will keep them in hotels until they're open, which right now is slated to open either December, January of this coming year. So I'm super excited about that. But then we will be able to provide ongoing permanent supportive housing case management to those families to help them be successful. So if you've been unhoused for a really long time and you suddenly get housed, it doesn't always just magically work. There's sometimes this phenomenon of, you know, when you're in fight or flight mode and your adrenaline has been high for a really long time, you're just trying to survive and get by. What we've learned from visiting a number of other housing projects like this around the West Coast, we went on tour with the Housing Authority, is that the lessons learned from the field are that oftentimes year one goes pretty well and year two is challenging. Like as adrenaline kind of calms down and people settle in to not having to literally survive hour to hour, day to day, then they start dealing with some of the things that they have not dealt with. So medical issues or lagging skills or the need to actually start looking for work. So our case managers, and part of what we've increased capacity there, it will be to support those families and keep that going in addition to supporting the currently unhoused clients that we're already serving. And so you'll see that we have asked for slightly higher asks than we normally have. And I'm not clear if there are additional funds just because of some of the federal supports or if it's the same as always, but I just wanted to help explain that we've leveraged and added a lot more capacity. We've added about 30% more clients, and we're adding this whole new program component to help these families ideally get stable, grow their skill set, grow their income, hopefully be able to move out of these units in time, and that will allow a new unit to open up, and that will remain a Maslow unit because it's project-based. And the tenants who then are able to move out into the open market will be able to take their project-based voucher with them. And then that opens up a new project-based voucher unit for a new family. So it's been going really well. It's a wonderful partnership we have with the Housing Authority. I'm super excited that this is happening in Ashland. And hopefully next year I'll have an update on that. And if you've ever wondered what it looks like to be a child and never have had your own room, your own bed, or bounced on a bed, the sheer joy on this little girl's face is what that looks like. We've been very, very supported by the community. We have several local businesses that have just really gone all out in helping. You can see our van is full of brand new mattresses, and we got furniture and kitchenware and a lot of like welcome home kits. And so we anticipate we'll have that same level of support at Snowberry too. And this is just an image of one of the children that was impacted by the fire. And just some continuing to support this huge unmet need between Phoenix Talent and Ashland. That will continue to be a resource that we will try to address over the next coming years. And these are two of our little guys that I just thought I would leave you with. Their parting pictures as a reminder that, you know, some of the people most impacted over this last year are those with the least amount of voice to articulate what their needs are. And so part of our objective is just to be their voice and make sure that their needs are heard as well. So with that, I'd love to just see if you guys have any questions and see if I can answer those for you.
So we're going to keep this part really quick because we want to go on and make sure that Aura has time to do a presentation.
I may be mistaken. I'm not, I don't have my notes in front of me, but you were, your proposal says 100 to 150 youth and their families in Ashland, correct?
That's correct.
But the goals of case management say 45. So what am I?
The difference?
Explain that to me.
Yeah, so we normally see about 100 total clients, and that's youth and or their parents. So about 100 in the city of Ashland. That has grown to about 150 this year, partially because of the fire and people relocating. So while we are providing some level of support, so basic needs, advocacy, outreach to all of those 150, case management is sort of like the most intensive. So it's usually either unaccompanied youth, domestic violence, survivors, sex trafficked youth. It tends to be the most triaged, most support, most resourced clients that we serve. So case management is like a subset of the 150 that are really receiving that intensive goal-based. And it's usually either going to be connected to housing or connected to like our high school students trying to keep them in school. And that's the difference between the two.
I just think you may be devaluing the other services because they're very important. And well, I consider them case management.
And those will continue to happen. So we're both are happening consecutively. Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
One more. Jackie.
I have no questions. I just want to thank you so much, Mary, for your presentation and say how much I value and the work you do with our families and young children and the difference that you're making with these families in Ashland and beyond. Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you for
your ditto. Thank you for your presentation today, Mary. All right. Are we ready to move on to the Aura presentation? Cass, is that you?
Yes, it is. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Mary, thanks for all the work you do in our community, and I appreciate partnering with you. So I am here today to talk about, I'm sure you're all familiar, that in January, Aura was the first organization in the state of Oregon to receive Operation Turnkey funding to purchase the Super 8 Motel. We're very excited about that. We're going operational on April 1st with modified operations, opening up 20 rooms. Then another 15 days later, we'll open another 10 rooms. And then another 15 days later, we'll open another 36 rooms. So our goal and our project goal that we submitted to you was to apply for funds to install an elevator to modify our existing swimming pool area, to fill that in, and to create a resource center area and shelter dining and a social area, as well as to install a fire suppression system in the Super 8. The operations, the renovations will start in June, and we will be in renovation while we will have guests at the shelter. And we're looking to have all the renovations finished in the perfect world scenario by the end of August, September. At that time, we will move our current resource center that's located next to Safeway into the Aura Center, and we will operate our headquarters there from the new Aura Center, priorly known as the Super 8. We will continue to operate our laundry shower trailer with our relationship with the Methodist Church from there on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we're currently doing about 40 showers a week there. So those are our project goals, and that's what we're looking to do.
Fabulous. Questions?
This isn't a question about the proposal, but I'm curious if you've surveyed the surrounding businesses in your location.
We have been in communication with businesses, and will continue to be in communication to let them know that we will be fully staffed 24/7 with 3 staff each shift. Working around the building. We have cameras around the building and within the building, and we'll really work to be great neighbors. Much like when we went into East Main, we really had some concerned neighbors there as well. And I think we really did a great job managing that as well. So we will continue the conversation.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I have a question, Cass. Currently, the bus service in Ashland ends, I think, at Shopping Cart.
Yes.
Is there any chance to have that extended just one more block so that your guests can actually get home at night?
That is a great question. And I have not, I learned of that recently, and that they had modified the bus stop that used to stop right in front of there. But that has come to my attention and is on my list.
Mm-hmm. Great. Anybody else? Heidi.
I just wanted to say this is so exciting.
Heidi Parker.
To see the growth and the support services. It's just awesome. I'm really thrilled and can't wait for my COVID to be over so I can go see it.
I can't wait either, Heidi. And yeah. Thank you for being at the forefront of this entire conversation. So,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank Laura.
Gina.
Thank you. I had a question regarding the bus stopping in front of the Super 8. I know the transit triangle is in place. So, and that's going to extend the bus route. So maybe that can impact getting it to go that additional block. So
good.
I walk around that neighborhood and there's a new street that goes from Washington over to Tolman Creek. So it would not be a very big loop to get it back on the track that it's going on.
So. Yeah, and it was originally supposed to go down Mistletoe. So it can definitely work. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. That I was rushing us along, but your presentation was so concise that we're kind of back on track here.
Good.
Thank you.
That was my goal.
This amazing year in the world of Aura. I have worked with you guys enough to know that there are angels everywhere in that organization. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda.
All righty. Are you still here? Do you need like a stretch break? Do you want to like just do one jumping jack and then sit back down? Okay. So we are in the very fortunate position from Linda's memo to us to have enough money to fund the requests if that's our preference. So I just want to, would you want to say some more about that, Linda?
Sure. I'm happy to talk a little bit about that. You know, we've talked a lot over the years. We've had a backlog of what's called capital funding. It's traditionally been very difficult for us to spend that money. We were able to spend a little bit of it through the COVID pandemic, but even that was a bit of a challenge. So we carried over about $160,000 of that into this program year. And then we also received a slightly higher allocation than we had anticipated. So that was interesting, which made it so that our public service amount was higher than it normally is, the 15% of the overall grant. And then we also carried over some funds from program year 2020. So we have had an interesting year of expending funding in ways that we weren't able to in the past. HUD passed a mega waiver due to COVID, which freed up some of the funding that we had from 2019 and then also allowed us to spend funds from 2020 in a different way. And then we received an additional allocation, actually two separate additional allocations, which HUD requires us to count as one, even though they gave them to us at separate times, of Special CARES Act funding. So we actually have about 115,000 of the CARES Act funding left. And then we have another 25,000 in 2020 funds that we're carrying into this year. So we actually have a lot of money, and we're able to, expend that funding to support both of these projects fully, which I know we'd rarely get to do. So what a relief that we don't have to have a big discussion about how it's painful to not provide someone with as much funding as they need. So I think we're really fortunate in that way. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that you may have about the funding moving forward. I'm not sure if this coming year, if we'll be receiving any additional allocations with that stimulus funding.
All right, so that is the staff recommendation. Before we go to a motion, we're gonna have some discussion about that. Heidi?
Yeah, I was confused about the amount because the numbers you gave us on the staff evaluation didn't all add up to the 295. So there are extra monies, and where
I'm sorry, I think I just moved Heidi and I didn't mean to move her. I'm sorry, Heidi, if you can hear me, I'm moving you back.
Come back.
It'll take just a second. I'm sorry, Heidi. Oh my gosh. I did not mean to do that. I actually am trying to move Mary and Cass back into attendees so that, okay, I'm going to keep trying. Go ahead.
Unmute yourself, Heidi.
So is there a place that all those numbers come together? And because I know there, I trust you, but it's not on paper here, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I have a table that I keep track of it. And I was updating that table today, and I will provide you guys, or I'll email it out tomorrow. Yeah, it's a lot of different numbers, and I have been separating them in weird ways because of the COVID funding being kept separate and then the mega waiver funding being kept separate. And then one of the things that happens to us all the time is that we fund projects in a given year, but some of those projects either don't fully expend all their funding or they don't move forward. And this was one of those cases where there were some projects that didn't move forward or didn't expend all their funding. And so there was some additional funding that I did not carry over initially. And so this spreadsheet that I can provide you will show that. The other thing that happens, which is strange, is that every now and again, I need to reconcile what HUD says we have in our accounts with what we say we have in our accounts. And at one point in time, not to go into a super long explanation, HUD used to do what was called their FIFO accounting, which was first in, first out. So the money that we got put into our line item account, they would just pull everything out of that. And then at about 2014, they switched from doing that to we chose which account things were coming out of, which is why we have a backlog of money in 2014, because I was pulling things that I paid for from that 2014 year from a different year. Well, actually, I guess it was 2015, and it stopped pulling it in order. And so that money sat there, and then I just continued to do that moving forward. And so accounting for that money in our IDIS account balance, and then sort of reconciling it with what I had in my spreadsheet, because I don't track it the way they do, was a matter of sorting through and figuring out why is it different than what I'm saying, and how do we make sure that that all equals out. So I think I have it under control now. And I think that you can see that in the spreadsheet a little bit more. And I actually have, unfortunately, a lot of spreadsheets. I have ones to track monthly how much we're spending on projects. whether people are drawing down their funding in a timely manner. And then at the end of the year, I have to tell the Ashland budget how much money we'll be carrying over into the following year. So I have to track it on in a really a much tighter way. And then there's the sort of, like I said, the way that HUD is tracking it and how that doesn't always match up with what I have. So anyway, that's my long-winded way of saying I apologize for not delineating it more in this document. But one thing that I found is that when I try to do that, it actually makes people more confused.
Okay, can you tell us what the balance of the amount we'll have left in the housing trust fund?
Oh, in the housing trust fund?
Yeah.
Well, so that was another interesting thing since you brought that up. So when we allocated funding to both Aura and Maslow at the council meeting a while back, the council gave us the discretion to choose from which pool we were drawing the money based on how we could get reimbursed from FEMA. So at that time, I had just looked at what the activities that were listed in the grant applications, and I just made a split based on what I thought FEMA would reimburse us for. But then after that, we did get some more information that FEMA would reimburse us for the congregate sheltering part because of the protections that ORA was taking. And so I was able to shift essentially all of the funding that I was able to expend the remaining balance of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund and shift some of what I was going to fund out of CDBG into the trust fund for reimbursement. So right now, the trust fund, I mean, it has money in it because we haven't drawn down the money, but it is all allocated to activities. We do expect to receive about $170,000 in reimbursement from FEMA. That's what we have requested from them, but we have not submitted those requests for reimbursement at this time. And so I don't know how that process will work. I mean, I'm hoping that it will work really well and they'll just, you know, give us a check and they won't say some of these things aren't things that we would consider eligible. So that's my fingers crossed. I'm actually attending a webinar tomorrow about that. And Brandon is the FEMA reimbursement person. So he will be taking the lead on that part. So yes, there's no money left in the housing trust fund. I don't have it right in front of me, but I think in order to fund both of these, we'll expend about $20,000 worth of just under $20,000 worth of the 2020 overage and the backlog of our about $160,000 worth of capital improvement and the new allocation. So we'll still have a remaining balance of about $120,000 worth of funds that can be used to address COVID. So funds that have no regulatory barriers on them, as long as we're addressing COVID-related activities moving forward. And I really have spoken to HUD in the last few days. They are not doing a timeliness thing, so we don't have to worry about expending funding to meet our timeliness test, but they really would like me to try to clear the balance out so that we can start fresh for the first time since 2013 that we wouldn't have carried a balance over into the next year. So I think we're getting close to that. And with the additional funding, we will probably go through some sort of process to see how we can allocate that funding as well, the COVID related funding. But we'll talk about that later.
That answer your question, Heidi?
It's a complex question.
It's a complex question. And I'm pretty sure I can speak for this whole commission in just saying how fortunate we are to have you, Linda, to do the money wizardry around all of these different accounts. You are a treasure. You're just a treasure.
Thank you. I don't know that I deserve it because I'm not sure that it's wizardry. Sometimes I think that it is very scary. Thank you.
I think for me, it would push me over the edge. So I think you're doing amazing things. So are we ready to have a motion around the staff recommendation? Heidi. Unmute.
Muted.
On your score sheet, on number F, the project maximizes partnerships in the community, and you gave them each a 2 on that. And I just wondered what that was about.
Sorry, I had to look it up and see. I don't know why I did that. I guess I thought I gave them both a 3. Pretty much these projects were 3s all the way.
yeah, and I think they do some amount of collaboration between.
Oh, they do. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Was it only you, Linda, that scored this, or were there other people involved?
Actually, this time it was only me. Most of the time it is me and Brandon and Bill, but this time it was just me going through it. And honestly, I mean, I think these were both easy applications to score. I think that both projects are really straightforward. Obviously, we've, you know, known the work that Maslow is doing for years, and we know that just like Aura, you know, there's an increased need and increased stress for both of these organizations. And I think their applications were just, you know, it just showed, you know, the good work they're doing. And with Aura's application, it's not something that they have done before. And it's also not something that, you know, we see a lot of, but the application was very sound. And I think all of the work that the pre-development work that they had done really showed in a pretty clear, objective way that the work they're doing is, you know, doable, accomplishable. I think their timeline is right on, and all of the activities were applicable and eligible.
Okay.
Is there a motion? Echo?
Should we do like one at a time, like a Maslow motion and then an Aura motion? Is that the best way to do that?
A show of hands if you feel like you need to divide them.
Or can they just be on one motion?
I think they can be on one. Nobody's saying they need it divided.
So I move that we approve the applications for Maslow project for client services in the amount of $25,000. And the application of options for helping residents of Ashland for the renovation of the Super 8 Motel in the amount of $270,170.
A second.
Second by Heidi. Any more discussion? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? 1 abstention. It passes.
Yay.
We are in the final 5 minutes.
Wait, Linda, do I have that right that Tom is abstaining?
Yes, I believe that was true.
Okay.
Did you want to say anything about that, Tom, or you just want to abstain?
Not me.
Are you talking about me?
Yes.
Yes.
I raised my hand for voting for.
Oh, okay. That was not an abstention. Okay. Good to know. So unanimous. Thank you. We are in the final few minutes of our meeting. We've got liaison reports, and I would really love to hear from those of you if you've got a report that you can report succinctly. And Gina.
I think Heidi wanted to say something really quick.
Okay, I'm sorry, Heidi.
Yeah, I think we have to have a roll call vote on this. At least that's what we've had to do in the past. So you have to call each commissioner's name and their vote.
All righty, I'm learning how to do this. Jackie Bachman.
Aye.
Tom Gunderson.
Aye.
Echo Fields.
Aye.
Rich Rohde.
Yes.
Heidi Parker.
Yes.
Chris Mahan.
Yes.
And I also say yes. So thank you.
Did you say Tom Gunderson?
Pardon?
Did you say Tom's? Yes. Okay.
I did. All right. Gina, do you have a report from the council?
You know, I don't necessarily have a report. I did read this. I really, really appreciate all of the work that was put into this. And I love the robust conversation and questions. Something that I'm learning, and it might be a bit of a battle for me, but something being on the commission for so long and now being on council, I'm noticing that we have all these things in place, and I don't know how to say this, so I'm just going to say it, that we have all of these wonderful things in place and surveys and work that Linda's done and Brandon's done and all of these things. I was on the commission for 7 years, and just seeing how slowly things move, that's how come I feel it's so important for the Housing and Human Service Commission and the Planning Commission to come together. And something that I have seen, and I will take the task on to see if I can get council to actually look at the cost. When you whittle it all down, what I see is the bottom line is the money, the cost for developers to come and build. People go to Talent, people go to Phoenix, people go to Medford. And when I realized that acronym SDC, and when I realized all of the permits and the fees and the cost, we have to actually incentivize these developers to get them here. Because if not, then all of the hard work and then the good work, you know, so that's what I am doing. I am working on how can we not mitigate, because we have to have permits and we have to adhere to a certain standard. However, we do not have to have this elite air about us, and then, you know, all of the hard work just goes to waste. So that's something, the conversation I started with Bill, I will continue it with Bill. I'll probably bug him until he's like, get the hook, get her out of here. But we have to have the conversation, and we have to start somewhere. So that's what I'm doing.
Wow. How lucky are we? We've got Gina on our team. Thank you.
Fingers crossed, guys. Fingers crossed. And maybe I can convince the other counselors that you might want to consider. So far, one counselor down and four more to go. So,
Chris, you want to give a report from SOU?
I don't have really anything new to report at this time, but Liz, just real quick on the meeting notes, you may want to change my last name for future edits. Anyways, nothing to report at this time. Thank you.
Great. Can I mention something?
Absolutely.
Referring to SOU and the students there, Chris and I have talked about how we can get students more involved, for instance, in the shelter work and all. And I did hear today that there is some hiring going on with some of the staff that will be working at the shelter and the resource center that are SOU students. So I wanted to be sure Chris knew that. What a wonderful opportunity in our community to have SOU students who want to do this work. So
is Tina, I don't know what her married name is. It was Roman when she was a student. Is she still at ORA?
Stevens. Yes. Tina Stevens.
Yes. I'm going to take credit for her. She's one of my kids.
Well, I give you a ton of credit then, because
she was one of our really awesome human services majors.
Oh,
so yes. she took two or three classes with me.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Finally, Linda, staff report, anything you haven't covered yet?
So I guess I have a couple of things. You know, the pallet shelters at the Unitarian Church are open now, and they have had some people in them. And the first couple of them have been a little bit bumpy. So we are having a meeting next week to discuss that. So I think the last time we had the meeting, we were talking about students having some, you know, being involved in the shelter system. I know that the Pallet Shelter Program, because it is run by the church and it's all church volunteers, would love to have some additional help. I had also been in touch, Echo, with someone at the college who did the Human Services Program and was looking for ways for their students to gain some practicum hours. Of course, I didn't.
Probably Kelly. It's probably Kelly.
I can't remember. Shot. Well, and we ended up not connecting. But if someone could help me get in connection with her again, and I don't know if they need to be overseen. I'm not sure how that works. But
Well, in the old days, yes, they would be supervised.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we could have a conversation about that. So I'm just, yeah. I guess I'm a little concerned because that program it's turning out to need a little more support. I don't know if it's because the people. Who are needing housing right now just need more support in general. So that's something that's moving forward, and I'll give you an update on that. You know, I think a lot of people would really like to see this program be successful and potentially expand. And so, you know, we want to try to support that in whatever way we